This is the first meeting of the Southern Nevada panel. Justice Lydia Stigwitch and Justice Ron Perry-Harry, and I'm Justice Michael Cherry. And I'm the presiding justice. And our first case today is case number 71419, Hobson versus State. Ms. Stewart for the appellant, and Mr. Ports for the prosecutors. Ms. Stewart.
Sandra Stewart is my name. This case arises out of several robberies of fast food restaurants over the course of a couple of months. The general modus operandi was to arrive shortly after closing when there would be no customers there, to gather all employees in one spot and determine who was the manager, to separate the manager from the other employees and direct the manager to open the safe, then they would take the money from the safe and leave. The defendant was charged with 82 counts. I attached a chart of the counts to the back of the opening brief, but I have another copy if that would be helpful in following along.
That's fine.
You're good?
Yes.
The main issues involved in the appeal are no notice of grand jury indictment as to counts 33 through 36. The jury veneer was not representative. That applies to all counts. State pretrial interference with witness Dante Johns, who was one of the three defendants. He entered into a plea bargain before trial. No evidence to support the kidnapping-related charges. That applies to 8 counts. The robberies were not supported by the evidence. That applies to 18 counts. And no evidence of conspiracy attempt for the Taco Bell incident on November 25th, 2014. And those are counts 81 and 82.
I'm curious as to how it happened that all these counts were tried in one trial. In my days, were there motions to sever any of these counts out?
I don't think that there was. I don't really recall that. They were all intertwined. It was called the Windbreaker series of robberies, and they all had the same modus operandi. The perpetrators wore the same clothes, the same gloves, same shoes. So I think that's why they were all tried together.
Well, was there an attempt maybe to separate some of these counts?
Not that I recall.
Were you the trial attorney?
No.
Okay. Who was the trial attorney? Do you remember?
I don't recall.
Okay. Why don't you tell us about the issue you think is the most important issue, and then if you still have time, the second most important issue, and then the third most important issue. If you can get to it, you've got about 12 minutes left. I'm assuming you're going to save a little bit of time for rebuttal.
I feel that the most important issue is that the jury veneer was not representative. Hobson, my client, and his co-defendant Starr were both African Americans. The veneer contained only 2 African Americans out of 65 people in the veneer, which is only 3%. Representation by African Americans. 10% of Clark County was determined to be African American.
Was there an evidentiary hearing on that issue?
Yes, there was. The district court analyzed the issue pursuant to Batson, which did not really apply.
Right.
Batson applies to peremptory challenges. They had the jury commissioner testify in the case that it uses 2 sources, DMV and Nevada Energy, to pick the jury veneer. But over and over again, the jury veneer is coming up short of African Americans. So Hobson contends that the jury veneer did not represent a fair cross-section of the community. In Williams, the court applied a 3-prong test set forth in Durant versus Missouri to determine whether a jury veneer is representative. And in that case, the court suggested that the jury commissioner should use three sources for picking the jury veneer rather than the two that are currently used.
Ms. Stewart, if I may, was there any evidence, I guess the question is whether or not using the DMV rolls, are the DMV rolls representative of the community as it would reflect the percentage of African Americans? The power bills help? Like what, you know, is that process, is this just a natural variation?
The DMV, of course, is only going to take into account people who have driver's licenses. And that has a wealth component to it for people who have cars. People who don't have cars are generally not going to have a driver's license. Or people who take the bus are not going to have a driver's license. As to the Nevada Power records, those also have a wealth component to them. A person is not going to have power in their name if they don't have a rental, a place to live in their name normally, or they may be living in their parents' basement, or they may be a roommate and the roommate has the power bill in their name. So in my view, both the DMV records and the Nevada Power records have a wealth component to them.
Was there evidence presented to reflect that? Like were any in terms of identification cards or driver's license that it's not capturing that? Like what objective evidence would you present to the judge that that's not a good method or that method falls short other than kind of generalizations that we all know the wealth component? Like what evidence did the judge have?
There was just argument about that and the testimony from the jury commissioner, which the jury commissioner felt that was representative. Argument by Hobson's attorney was that it was not representative and that it involved a wealth component, which records, for instance, from the United States Post Office would not involve that component. People on welfare, even in some cases homeless people would receive their mail somewhere. So that's the position on that the place where the names are being taken are being taken from something which involves a wealth component, and many African Americans are living below the poverty level. So there is never going to be a representative cross-section of the community using just those records.
Let me ask you this. There's an indication that you have a three-part test to satisfy, and one of those parts is that the underrepresentation is due to systematic exclusion of the group in the jury selection process. Can you address that? How is this a systematic exclusion using DMV records and Nevada Energy records as well?
Well, in my mind, it's by definition a systematic exclusion if you're using records that have a wealth component that go with them, which is the position of Hobson. You're not going to have a driver's license usually unless you have a car. You're not going to have you're not going to be in the Nevada Power records unless you have power in your name, which is not going to happen in many cases where people are living with roommates, etc. So just by the very nature of the records, it's a systematic exclusion of the group.
We've indicated in a case, a previous case, Battle, that that didn't constitute or didn't satisfy the third prong systematic exclusion. We've addressed that previously. Do you want to quickly address that?
I don't have that case in my note, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I would be happy to address
that.
That's
an order.
It
was an order. It wasn't an opinion, but it was instructive.
I would be happy to look at it and address it in subsequent briefing if you'd like.
Mr. You'd agree, though, there is statistical information available from the DMV besides anecdotal. You could get the information that you're talking about.
What information do you mean?
As it relates to the percentage of African Americans who are captured by the DMV system. The info's there.
I don't believe that was testified to at trial.
Correct.
By the jury commissioner, and I'm limited to the record at trial. So that didn't come out as to what the percentage of people in the DMV records are African American and whether or not that satisfies or even comes closer to the 10% that are actually represented in the community. And that 10% was as of 2015. I would assume that there is a larger percentage of African Americans in the community at this time.
I don't understand why the trial attorney didn't immediately file something with us when there were two African Americans out of 65 and the motion for was denied as to getting some more African Americans or balancing out the jury pool. I think that that was a real mistake, but it's too late. It's water under the bridge, I guess they say.
Any more questions on this issue?
No, ma'am.
Okay, I'd like to move on to the kidnapping issue. This arose in the context of people trying to escape in a few of the incidents. Robber would come in from the front, break the window and come in, then the other robber would go around to the back, and as they were coming in the back, there would be people trying to leave, and the robbers would just push them back in. The reason for that is that they wanted to have the group together so they could identify which one was the manager and had the combination for the safe. So the argument that Hobson is making is that the movement of those people back into the restaurant was incidental to the robbery and did not create a substantial risk of harm to those individuals. They were all rounded up. The manager was identified, separated from the group, directed to open the safe, and then the robbers took the money from the safe and left. So there are several cases in Wright. Victims were moved from room to room and tied up. That was not kidnapping. In Jefferson, victims were moved to the back of the store and tied up. That was not kidnapping. In Hutchins, a victim was dragged through an apartment, choked and beaten. That was kidnapping. In Garcia, a victim was moved outside the building and held at gunpoint for 15 minutes, then moved back inside the store. That was kidnapping.
But could a rational jury find kidnapping in these cases?
Beg pardon?
A rational jury, could they find kidnapping?
Could they find kidnapping?
Yes.
I don't believe so, because the movement was incidental to the robbery and did not create substantial risk of additional harm.
But didn't Stewart versus State, which is, are you familiar with that one?
I don't have that one in my notes.
All right, it's 2017, and this court opined that whether the movement of the victim is incidental to the associated offense and whether the risk of harm is substantially increased thereby are questions of fact to be determined by the trier of fact in all but the clearest cases.
Well, I think this is a clear case where that did not occur, and if you look back at the factual situations in the various cases, the times when the court has found that it was kidnapping was where there was actually injury to the victims. In this case, there was no injury to the victim. They were never threatened with injury, although they did have guns.
You have 2 minutes left. Do you want to save any time?
Beg your pardon?
You have 2 minutes left for rebuttal. Do you want to save any time?
I'll save that for rebuttal.
Okay. We'll round it off to 2 minutes. Mr. Portis.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Nick Portis on behalf of the respondent. Before I begin addressing some of the matters raised by opposing counsel, I do want to point out an issue, facts directly pertinent to the fair cross-section challenge raised by the appellant in this matter that was not presented to this court in the briefing in preparation for argument. As you know, this was a lengthy trial some time ago. It came back to us that there was, in fact, a second veneer brought up in this matter. So there was the first veneer in which there were, I believe, two African-Americans or individuals who identified as African-American, and the challenge was raised. The court held an evidentiary hearing in which the jury commissioner testified and found that there was no systematic exclusion, and therefore they failed to meet their burden to challenge the veneer. This was a lengthy trial. There were a number of jurors who were unable to, prospective jurors who were unable to serve as a matter of the fact that it would take about 3 weeks. We had to bring up a second panel the next day. And that second panel was brought up. The court gave the defense, both counsel for the defense, time to review the records and determine whether or not they wished to issue another challenge based on the composition of the panel. Upon review of the panel, the defense conceded that there was a number of African-American jurors in this matter, or in this veneer, that fairly and accurately represented the cross-section of the community. They did not put into the record that number. To my recollection, it was far in excess of 10%. But it should be noted to the court, and that's going to be volume 8, page 1728 of the appendix, that the defense conceded that the veneer in the second group was commensurate with any proportions, and they had no challenges for the fair cross-section. I would note in the three-prong analysis that this court reviews, prong number 2 states the representation of the group, the distinctive group, in this case African Americans, from the veneers, and that is in plural, the veneers from which the jury is selected is not fair and reasonable, given the number, in relation to the number of such persons in the community. The defense's concession as to the second veneer representing an accurate, or in my recollection, more than accurate number of members from the African American community on that second veneer is a concession that they did not meet the second prong. On top of that, the state has presented, the defense failed to present sufficient evidence to meet the third prong, as was clearly litigated in the with the jury commissioner. And I think this goes to what the courts recognize, is that, listen, these are randomly chosen individuals from what should be a statistically accurate group of people, as far as demographics are concerned. So there will be occasions on which there are panels or veneers in which there are underrepresentations of certain specific groups. There are cases where there will be overrepresentations. Each single individual case is merely, as the courts pointed out, anecdotal. It's one tiny example that should be examined in context of all the examples, the thousands of cases that come and go to jury trial in Clark County and in all of Nevada, and only the handful that bring up a cross-section challenge before this court, shows that that's falling in line with the notion that statistically speaking, there will be times in which there are fewer than commensurate numbers of a specific group and a challenge might be raised. And that's fair. I think this case is clearly indicative of the fact that the process, one, is fair and is pulling from a fair cross-section. Yes.
Does the Clark County Jury Commissioner collect? Well, strike that. Do the cards that the jury fills out ask for race? Is that collected in any fashion?
It's and from what I gathered from the jury commissioner's testimony in this matter, this is what's problematic with the notion of challenging the fair cross section. If they believe there's an issue, I would submit the evidence shows from case to case that there is not. But if they believe there's an issue, there are more effective means of challenging and amending how the jury commissioner pulls individuals than raising an issue 10 minutes before the jury comes in and holding a 25-minute hearing with the jury commissioner. But if we look at what the jury commissioner sends out for the pool for May 4th, and this is in the record, the May 4th, 2015 pool, 1,001 prospective jurors responded to their jury summons. Of those 1,001 jurors in which they do list their racial component,
That was my question.
464, 46.4%, almost half, did not respond or acknowledge what they would identify with as far as racial components are concerned. So you're already dealing with, when you're looking at the pool that we pull from, insufficient records, because we're not compelling people to identify with a particular race when they respond to these. So if you don't know what half of the pool is, you can't necessarily state that there's some sort of systematic exclusion. We're dealing with insufficient numbers here. I think, as the court pointed out, they should be pulling DMV records and the interview records to get to a deeper analysis of that conclusion. And it's their burden, and they failed to do that here. I would also note that the jury commissioner stated that there's a lot harped upon this being a wealth component. The jury commissioner stated during her testimony, this is the evidence in the record, that it's not just people with driver's license from the DMV which they're pulled. It's anyone with an identification. Anyone who works in this community needs an identification, typically, to provide or apply for a job. Whether you own a home, own a car, or anything, you have to acquire an identification card, and that can come from the DMV, and those are part of the records, according to the jury commissioner, from which we pull from. So I don't think that this wealth component, one, was ever fleshed out by the defense during their challenge, two, is it's belied by the record on appeal. I did want to address the kidnapping, which was also raised by opposing counsel. The state didn't charge kidnapping in every single one of these incidents, even though in every single one of these incidents, the defendants entered the store, held people at gunpoint, detained them while they perpetrated or committed their robbery. The three incidents in which we did charge, there is video evidence, as well as testimony, that these victims actually escaped, got outside of the building, and were then forcibly detained and forced back into the building, from outside, back into the building for the purpose of perpetrating the robbery. Now, the issue has been litigated to death in the record. It was litigated at the pretrial writ. The arguments were made before the jury, as the court has pointed out, that it should be a factual determination to be made by the jury, and the jury came back with its verdict. It's being litigated now. There's not much more I can add to the record other than to point out for the record that, in these three incidents in which we charged it, there's video and testimonial evidence that these victims actually exited the building and then were forced from a public sphere, public space of safety. The reason they're running outside is to get outside where it's safe, and forced from an outside area back into an enclosed space with the door closed where the robberies were then perpetrated at gunpoint. I do also want to note that as to counts 63 and 65, there was cash on the counter that could have been taken without anyone there, that in every single incident, the safes that are used here, we're not talking about 20-foot vaults bolted into the wall at a bank. We're talking about a 2-foot-high-by-1-foot little safe inside a Popeye's chicken kitchen. These are cases, and they're not bolted to the ground, which can be seen from the photographs here. These are things that can be taken without a manager or an employee present. If there are any other additional questions,
I've got a comment.
Yes.
I know the grand jurors are tools of the prosecutors, and some people have said you can indict a ham sandwich. How did you happen to indict on counts 33 to 36 when no evidence was presented?
That was as noted by the state, a clerical error. There were a significant number of victims, a significant number of charges in this case, as we all know. The state served mark on noticing defense counsel of all counts, including counts 33 through 36. And that was a mark and notice served on December 3rd of 2014, far in excess of our 5-day requirement presenting to the grand jury. At the second grand jury indictment, we put on almost, I think 13 of the 14 counts were put on at the second indictment. Counts 33 through 36, there were two witnesses the state intended to present to the grand jury that day. One of the witnesses showed and testified. So there was a witness that actually testified as to those counts. However, a second witness was necessary in the state's opinion to meet its burden for purposes of the grand jury presentment. And we notified the grand jury in that statement, in that presentation, at the very beginning, and this is a direct quote, that as to counts 33, 34, 35, and 36, we're going to ask you to withhold deliberation on these counts because one of the witnesses was missing. One of the two. So we actually presented testimony about that incident, but not sufficient enough. It was a clerical error that those matters were raised up in the indictment. And the second the state noticed it during the writ challenge, because the defense didn't notice it, we notified the defense, we notified the court that those counts were in fact not bound up and should not be litigated on a pretrial writ at this point, that we will be presenting our final witness on that matter. So there was more than sufficient notice, technically 141 days notice in the Markham, where the event number from counts 33 through 36 were explicitly stated. The defense had well been on notice of that, and in fact didn't even know that they thought our presentation was appropriate, even though we told the grand jurors not to deliberate on it. We then subsequently presented that final witness, and those counts were added as well.
What about robbery of employees that did not have a possessory interest in the stolen cell phones?
I do want to address three counts of robbery in this case, with use. In preparation for this argument, and again in further review of the record, the state's willing to concede the following. Count 25, Mr. Jesus Dormey. That was, as the court pointed out, a cell phone by an employee. It was not his cell phone. We'll concede he did not have a possessory interest. He was clearly present. There's video evidence of that, but that's neither here nor there, as we're conceding he did not have a possessory interest. Count 39, Noemi Mariquin. The state is willing to concede that victim was a guest on the premises and not an employee, and therefore had no possessory interest in the money of the store that was taken. That should have been charged as an assault with a deadly weapon, but that was not done. And then finally, count 66, Ms. Hadid, was the second instance in which the perpetrators, the defendant, Mr. Hobson, in this case, failed to complete his robbery by taking money from the store and subsequently took Ms. Hadid's co-worker's cell phone. It was charged as a cell phone robbery, and so we'll concede that she did not have a possessory interest in that.
So let me see, it's counts 25, 39, and 66?
That's correct.
Also, what about the alleged prosecutorial misconduct about a fellow who pled guilty, and there was supposedly trouble for the defense to try to talk to the prisoner?
Well, that just was not borne out at all by the record. It's 100% factually inaccurate. And their own argument in their opening brief is that the defendant, and they quote him from his testimony, from his attorney's testimony, because the court held a hearing, I believe, where the attorney testified. The defendant, or Mr. Johns, excuse me, the flipped co-defendant, told his attorney that he was willing to meet with defense counsel. He came to his attorney and said, I'm willing to talk to these guys. That in and of itself shows that there was no interference by the state, that he did not believe he was not allowed to talk to the defense attorneys in this case. Now, he said, based on advice of counsel, I've chosen not to. That's his right to decide whether or not he's going to speak to anyone. Whether he wants to speak to the state, it's his right to decide. He can't be compelled. So I think their argument crushes in on itself in that they openly acknowledge that Mr. John says, I was open to talking to them until I talked to my attorney, and then based on the advice of counsel, chose not to. Unless there are any other matters the court wishes me to address, I know that there's issues with the two final counts. And there was also an argument by appellant regarding employees not having a possessory interest in the money taken from their store. I'd be happy to address any of those unless if the court has no questions, I would be happy to sit down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Reed, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
As to the second jury veneer, counsel said that he felt that 10% of the people in that veneer were African Americans. However, that was not in the record.
What records would you deem appropriate for selecting a jury veneer other than the DMV records, understanding that it's not just driver's license but identification cards as well, and NV Energy records? What else do you, in your opinion, think would be more helpful in selecting a cross-section?
Post office records.
But post office records aren't going to identify age. I mean, that's a boondoggle. That could be 2 million names that don't identify somebody who's eligible for jury service.
And if you said that you just indicated some of your basis is for systematic exclusion, and that was that some people live in the basements of their parents' home, how would post office records help that?
Well, those people would still be receiving mail.
And how do you know?
Well,
you're just kind of assuming. What else would you point to besides post office records?
That's the main thing that came to my mind was post office records.
And do most other jurisdictions use post office records as well as DMV? And
I don't know of any jurisdictions that do, no. Counsel said that as to the kidnapping, that the people who were pushed back into the building, were already outside the building. That's not true. They were pushing the door, and the person was coming in and pushed them back through the door. There was only one woman that had 1 foot outside the building. They were not completely outside the building running away, and they went and grabbed them and put them back into the building. So that was not true.
So they wouldn't let them exit?
They wouldn't let them exit, that's correct. But they were in the building except for one woman. Oops. Do I need to stop?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court thanks Ms. Stewart and Mr. Portz. We thank Ms. Stewart. I know it was difficult to try to do this case when you weren't the trial attorney. Mr. Portz, thank you for clearing up some of the issues. I think both of you did the best job you could, to tell you the truth. This matter will stand submitted.